One of my favorite childhood memories is of lying on the couch in my living room, kind of curled up on my side behind my dad, who would be sitting there in front of me, either reading the newspaper or watching TV. More often than not, if it was TV, he would be watching Star Trek, the original series. And so every week, I would see images of these science fiction people exploring strange new worlds and seeking out new life and new civilizations, just like it said at the beginning of every show. How many of you are familiar with Star Trek? Okay. Basically, for those who are not necessarily, the series was set in the 23rd century, a time when humans were imagined to have evolved to the point of living peaceful lives focused on self-improvement and fulfillment. This state, some people call Gene Roddenberry a visionary for this. This state had only come about after near devastation of the Earth, which was a wake-up call for them to come together. And there were aliens, some of whom were friendly to the humans and others who were not, and there was space travel, so the humans and the aliens were in contact with each other. The friendly aliens had banded together with the humans and formed the United Federation of Planets, which had a subgroup of intergalactic peacekeepers and explorers called Starfleet. And Starfleet sent out these crews who were more likely than not mixed race of human and alien and different kinds of looking humans and aliens out into space to explore other planets and their inhabitants. Star Trek episodes told the stories of a particular group of explorers from the United Federation of Planets who were sent out to learn what was out there, and their starship was called Enterprise. The episodes were pretty simple. Usually they involved the crew of the Enterprise finding an inhabited planet and setting out to learn something about its people and their customs, only to discover that some aspect of the aliens' culture was in opposition to their own customs or ethics. A conflict would ensue, and more often than not, a crew member in a red shirt would lose his life, and Captain Kirk's shirt would become torn, before the Enterprise crew learned something that helped them grow in their understanding of their own nature. The dialogue was short, decisions were made quickly. Captain Kirk and his crew had a very well-developed sense of what was right and wrong and used it to evaluate the civilizations they encountered. The second series, Star Trek: The Next Generation, was set almost 100 years later, and it ran from 1987 to 1994, where the original was in the late 60s. I had reached adulthood by then, and Dad and I were both really excited when this new series began. And when we saw the first episode together, I was even more excited, and I think he was disappointed, because Star Trek had changed considerably. And Dad, being of the generation he was of, still lived in that same world of simple plots and short communications and quick decisions. And I aspired to a world that thought things through and consulted others and tried much harder to avoid conflict. As you heard in the readings, the ways in which the Next Generation crew made decisions and carried out their mission were quite different from how things happened with the original Enterprise crew. To be fair, I have to admit that I did a little cherry picking on how I presented these readings. Before they attacked the Romulans, who had crossed illegally into the neutral zone and almost certainly destroyed the Federation outpost on its edge, there actually was a conversation between Captain Kirk and his crew about whether to engage. But it differed wildly in character from the conversation you heard from Jean-Luc Picard's Enterprise. In both episodes, the Enterprise was on the edge of this neutral zone, an area of space that had a treaty specifying that neither the Federation nor the Romulans could enter it. Federation outposts had been destroyed, and it's suspected strongly that it was done by the Romulans, and both crews, the crews of both time ships, expect hostilities from the Romulans when they arrive, and both captains do discuss options with their crews. But while Captain Kirk chooses to engage aggressively and eventually, I'll do the spoiler, manages to outmaneuver and outfight the Romulans, Captain Picard says that the use of force would be a sign of failure, and he doesn't follow the advice of several of his crew members to attack the Romulan ship. Instead, Picard learns that Romulan outposts were also decimated, and he actually persuades the Romulans, after centuries of enmity and warfare, into a very limited and very brief cooperative agreement that could allow both groups to discover who really attacked them. Systems change as different generations move into engagement. Picard's crew needed a counselor, someone who could read emotions and advise the captain on his approach with people. It included a Klingon, a member of one of the alien races most feared by the people of Captain Kirk's time, one who didn't equate the part of his ship's... And Picard himself was a very different leader from Captain Kirk. Picard didn't equate the part of his ship's mission that said to boldly go where no one has gone before with aggression. To Picard, boldly simply meant with forethought and with courage. This brings to mind a conversation I had recently, just yesterday actually, about the changes that technology are creating in our lives. Moving from records to cassette tapes to CDs to MP3 players didn't just change the quality of our music. Each step changed how we might listen to our music. And so now we can mix up our music based on anything we want, our mood, the music style, an inspirational goal. You know, some of us have jogging music and some of us have yoga music, and we couldn't do that with records. Personally, I still struggle with the idea that I don't have to listen to a whole album all at once. I was telling a friend yesterday about my current transition from paper calendar to Google Calendar, and she noted that the change wasn't just about where I keep my calendar. There's this internal shift that has to happen during even as simple a transition as that, which is about how my time changes based on the visual input of the different calendar format, right? So I've got this big paper form calendar with all these things written out on them, and now I've got this little screen that I have to click on to find out what the day's events are. Our emotional and our spiritual adjustments, we realized, happen much more slowly than the technological advancements that trigger them. This is true of many kinds of transition, I think. For example, our congregation's mission statement is printed on the front of your order of service. I invite you to pull that out and read it aloud with me now. We embody a broad spectrum of cultures, lifestyles, and creeds, honor the earth and the seasons of nature, value truth and reason over doctrine and dogma, encourage social action in the name of liberty and justice, celebrate our community and the journey of life, and unite in our quest for personal and spiritual growth. There are a lot of ways we can embody that vision. And I'm pretty sure that they have already evolved somewhat during this congregation's 21-year existence. We've been bold. We've boldly gone in our social justice work during this past year, for example, taking the time to discuss with respect and integrity for each other and for our community how we want to engage in the Black Lives Matter movement and then doing it. I have been bold in approaching ways we might embody a broad spectrum of people, likely making some of you a little uncomfortable in the process. Another minister might have been bold in other ways, and you might have learned to be bold with them in other ways. Another time might have called us into boldness in other parts of our mission and will in the future. and annual changes in our board and our congregational leaders will inevitably lead to changes in how we live that mission. And eventually, as we grow or we experience turnover or witness changes in our surrounding community, we'll find that this mission statement needs to change to reflect how we see ourselves and our work in the world. And we will have to change inside ourselves during that process. There's another kind of neutral zone that has to do with what happens as we evolve in these ways. In his book, Managing Transitions, William Bridges writes about three stages of institutional change. He calls the first stage ending, losing, or letting go. This is when a new idea is presented, and people have to get used to the idea of ending a particular way of doing things, like me and my albums. This is hard for people, and they become anxious, which sometimes leads to resistance to the idea in the first place. Bridges calls the last stage of change the new beginning. This is when people have embraced the change and they see its positives, and there's a lot of energy around the new way of doing things. Between the stages is what he calls the neutral zone. This is the time in which we've left the shore and we're swimming towards the distant shore. We turn around and we can no longer see the shore that we have left, because we've gone so far, and then we turn forward, and we can't see our destination either. This makes us uncomfortable. And our response is typically to want to go back or to move ahead as fast as we possibly can to get to that other shore. We could easily find ourselves in this place around how we move forward with our justice work, for example. The congregation has approved a statement of conscience on racial justice, and there are starting to be conversations about what we will do to show that statement in our lives and in our work together. How will we live that? We have left the shore of stating our intention, and we know we want to reach a place of new beginning in which we're fully engaged in the racial justice work of this community. But we're not sure how we might get there, and the ship has sailed. We're in the neutral zone, and we can keep our and each other's anxiety at bay by talking with each other, by offering knowledge and wisdom, by offering feedback to our individual responses. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is quoted as saying, "Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase." This is what getting into the neutral zone is about, and it's how Captain Picard made his decisions. It's how I've tried to operate this past year. I'm not sure what exactly I need to do to further my understanding of my role in anti-racism work, but I have faith that I'll find what I need as I move forward. So I keep my mind and my heart open to the possibilities. I will listen to the people doing the work I'm trying to engage in, and I'll make myself available to those people. One of Dr. King's inspirations, indeed, one of the inspirations of the Black Liberation Movement, is in the story of the Israelites being freed from slavery in Egypt. In this story, when God appeared to Moses in the burning bush, and Moses asked God, "How shall I call you?" God's response was, "Ehe Asher Ehe." This is most usually translated into the English, "I am that I am." It's a pretty static term. I am that I am. A more common translation in the Hebrew Bible is, "I will be who I am becoming," implying that God is a process, and that we, made in God's image, are also a process. If this is a true depiction of human and divine nature, then we can take from it reassurance that change, as the cliche says, change truly is a constant, and a natural one, a natural constant. And maybe we can find some assurance that the neutral zone can be crossed peacefully and faithfully. May it be so. May we be so.